You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, December 21st, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan is off tonight. But he will be sending in the answers to Who's That Noisy later on in the show.
And today in history, it's the solstice.
It's the winter solstice. That's correct. December 31st.
Yay.
This is the time when something stands on its edge?
No, that's the vernal equinox and is also untrue.
That's true. Now, things you can stand eggs on their edge on the vernal equinox, but you can do
as
it
well as every
other day of the year, too.
Right.
Yes, thank you for being pedantic.
You're welcome. But this is my favorite day of the year in that this is
what?
When the days start getting longer.
That's the stupidest favorite day of the year I've ever heard.
I like mentally.
What about your birthday? What about Christmas?
I have this image in my head of the analemma, you know, with it.
Yeah.
And I always feel like I'm turning the corner now on the bottom of the analemma. Now we're going to be start heading back up for the next 6 months. That's nice.
Wait,
I like
what?
That.
The analemma is the figure, the shape that the sun traces out in the sky over the course of the year. It's like an elongated figure eight, right, Steve?
Yeah,
remember Professor Coffin in high school?
Yeah.
Mapped it out on the floor of the science lab. I'll never forget that. But that's the shape it creates. So you're saying it's at the lowest end, right? It's at the bottom of the figure eight and it's heading
what
back
shape?
Up.
Oh, it is a figure eight.
It's a figure eight.
I have an interesting question to ask you guys. I asked a friend of mine at one point, how do they visualize the week and the year, right? So I have a particular way that I visualize the week and the year, and they're very similar. So if you in your mind visually think of Monday to Sunday, how does it look? Does it look like a calendar, or does it have a different shape to it in your head?
Mine looks like a butterfly.
Wow.
I mean, I visualize it like a calendar, but I always put Monday first and then the weekend separate. You know what I mean?
To me, it's kind of like a misshaped circle. Like Monday would be to the left middle, and then the week drops down kind of like a smile, right? So it goes down to Wednesday, up to Friday, and then the weekend kind of just is like a smaller curve over to Monday, right?
Wow.
That's how I visualize the week. I visualize the year kind of almost as a circle. Like right now we're in winter and we're at the bottom of the year. So when I think about it, I see myself kind of right at the bottom at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, I kind of do the same thing except
wow.
as an analemma. You know, is that figure eight instead of a circle. So we're at the bottom right now.
I don't know. I just kind of roll with it. I don't have an image in my head of a week.
He doesn't spend all of his time thinking about the calendar.
the week does never shape for me.
Well, Rebecca's is a butterfly. That's pretty tricked out.
Weeks are butterflies, and what are years? Unicorns or rainbows?
Don't be stupid, Steve. It's a dragon.
Uh-oh.
Well, we better get on to some news items before this degenerates any further. Bob, tell us about WIMPs and dark matter.
Yeah, dark matter was in the news this past week. Some articles you may have read kind of overplayed it. They were saying that dark matter finally found, and that's definitely kind of going overboard. One thing, though, that did happen, though, the scientists did really notice some decent candidate particles that could actually one of these days turn out to be dark matter. Once they get more data going through. But these results came in from the cryogenic dark matter search, which is it's an array of particles detectors 747 meters deep in some mine in Minnesota. I never actually heard of this installation, but it seems pretty interesting. What they actually may have detected is called a WIMP, or weakly interacting massive particle. As the name implies, these particles, they have mass, but they only interact with matter in the feeblest of ways. I think they only interact through gravity and the weak force. In this way, they're kind of like the neutrino. So dark matter might be something like this. There might be these vast clouds of WIMPs, these weakly interacting massive particles, embedded throughout galaxies that are exerting quite a bit of gravitational influence, but not much else, unfortunately, which makes them so hard to detect. Apparently, the scientists expect some specific electrical and heat characteristics from the WIMPs. So they have a theory on how they actually could be detected apart from any gravitational interaction, which would be tough if you're only detecting a few of these things. And this is what they've been looking for in their detectors since 2003. So they've been looking for these things for 6 years, and they actually did find something, but they're not 100% sure exactly what it is. The problem is that when you've got this detector deep underground, occasionally these stray particles are going to enter the detector, and they create this background noise that can mimic the WIMPs. So there's a 25% chance that this is exactly what happened. So it's way too big, 25% is way too big to go all Pons and Fleischmann on dark matter. They really got to wait until they narrow it down a bit. Hopefully in the next 2 years, they'll get enough data. And even if they don't, there's so many other different types of detectors out there that could potentially detect dark matter particles, including the LHC, that some scientists are saying that next year will likely be the year of dark matter. We might make some big breakthroughs next year.
Is that a prediction, Bob?
I'll save it.
It would be interesting. We're starting to see that. You know, it's like the kind of buzz that was around before the Wright brothers invented, you know, the flying machine. That everyone thought somewhere was going to invent it, and we kind of have that same buzz. It's like
I could definitely see a movie coming out of this, dark matter possibly discovered in an abandoned mine shaft somewhere in the Midwest. It's a horror film.
Oh, God. Well, I think it's a lot less tangible, Steve, than, you know, a lot of different people working on a flying machine. You know, like there's a lot of luck involved here too, right? Would you think? And listen to me talking about things I have no idea about again, right?
Jay's like, well, we know it's not a unicorn.
Yeah.
Let's start there.
One more news item this week. We're going to talk about synesthesia. We've talked about this before. You guys remember?
Synesthesia
is awesome. It's when one sensory modality bleeds over into another, so you may hear lights or see sounds, or numbers may have a color or a shape to them. Essentially, one kind of information in the brain there's a secondary sensory perception to that input. Now, there's been an interesting bit of research, a few bits of research that I was unaware of until recently, that put a slightly different spin on what synesthesia might be. The concept of synesthesia, it's only the one that I had, and I think the one that is consistent with what I've been reading, is that it's essentially, if you imagine like adjacent brain areas dealing with different sensory modalities, just sort of one carrying over into the next one that's right next to it. So you can think of it almost as a little bit of signal leakage to nearby brain areas, right? Turns out that may not be all there is to synesthesia, and in fact, it may not be essentially what it is. There has been a study by Jamie Ward and colleagues at the University of Sussex looking at color grapheme synesthetes, those who see numbers and letters as having colors. And what they did was they give them a specific test where, for example, if you have a puzzle where you have the number 2 constructing some picture, and the number 2 is embedded in a field of 5s, right? So on the sheet of paper, you just see 2s and 5s. But if you can pick out all the 2s, it would make a shape. And you have to see what the shape is. Have you ever guys ever done that puzzle? It's really hard. It's really hard for your mind to pick out the 2s from the 5s and to put it all together and see the shape emerge. But if you have color grapheme synesthesia,
it's easy as hell.
The 2s pop out because it has a different color. Now you're looking at like red on green or something. Right. So they perform much better on this test.
So that's how you can prove that they're actually a synesthete.
Yeah, but Steve, I never thought for a second that there wasn't something much more profoundly complex about synesthesia. I mean, there was a guy, I remember seeing a TV show, I bet a lot of people that listen to the show have seen it. It's fascinating about, you know, he's this very, very intelligent guy, way off the charts intelligent, and he's the guy that learned a language in 1 week,
Horizon documentary, The Man with the Amazing Brain, I think it was called.
And he had, like, complex math in his head as shapes.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And it was consistent. They'd ask him the same numbers over, like big numbers, over and over again, and he had consistent shapes for them. And that's synesthesia. I'm sure that's a part of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you're right. And there's cases like that which suggest that there's a little bit more complexity to it, right? It's not just like sight bleeding over into sound or one or the other. But what Ward did with that test, with that particular puzzle, is he gave the subjects only 1 second to see the shape. He compared, you know, the synesthetes to normal controls, and he found that when he gave the synesthetes only 1 second to see the shape, they only did 40% better, or only 40% of the time were they able to do better than the normal controls, right? And what the people told him was, is that the numbers only really have color where they're focusing their attention and not where they're not focusing their attention. So if they happened to be looking at the part of the field where the shape was, they would pick it out. But if they weren't looking right at it, they wouldn't see it.
And cool, okay.
So that suggests that attention needs to be in the loop in order for the synesthesia to take effect.
And that brings in another area of the brain then.
That brings in a widely distributed area of the brain, right? That's not just one other piece of the brain.
Yeah,
that means
right.
that synesthesia is resulting from
a global thing.
Yeah, really a complex sort of interaction of different parts of the brain. So this is not just a leakage of signal from one area to the next. This is a difference in hardwiring and the way different parts of the brain talk to each other. It's a much more complex phenomenon than maybe was previously assumed, which is very, very interesting. And does explain better, much better, those people who have synesthesia related to abstract concepts. Now, get this. There's other evidence. I found another study. When I read this, I looked for more studies to see if what else was there to support this. And this was done at the Max Planck Institute that also was looking at color grapheme synesthetes. And what they found is that the synesthetes can transfer their color associations.
Transfer them how?
So listen, so they showed the synesthetes characters from an obscure language. They called it glagolitic language that none of them spoke, which has a different set of characters. And they instructed them to basically associate the same color. Like, take the color you associate with the letter A and associate it with this character. Take the color you associate with the letter B and associate it with this character.
Holy they can consciously program
it? Yes, they consciously transferred the color associations to the new language that they did not understand.
What the hell?
And then after just 10 minutes, many of them reported that the transfers stuck, and they now saw those new characters with the colors that they had transferred over. And you know how they confirmed that this was a real effect and not just subjective?
They did a similar test.
They did a Stroop test. You know what the Stroop test is? You guys
yes,
remember this?
Yes.
This
yep.
is a pillar of psychological testing.
Excellent.
In this area. The Stroop test is where if you look at the word red, you know, R-E-D, it written in blue ink, and you're told to say the color of the ink, not the color of the word, there's a delay because you have to suppress your instinct to read the word. And that you can't make that delay go away.
So unless it's upside down.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're seeing it in a way that you can read it, you can't suppress it. You know, you could minimize
right,
it,
right.
but you can't make it go away entirely. So that's a way of proving that somebody can read the language in which the test is being done. Now, they did the Stroop test, and if they're seeing the colors, if the colors are associated with it, then they would have to suppress that their seeing of that color, right? And the Stroop test confirmed that there was a delay, that there was an effect there. So they had actually transferred the color associations.
Well, not just transferred, but just like copied, right? I mean, they didn't lose it for normal.
No, no. Well, right. I mean, yeah. Of course, they didn't lose it, but they called it transferring, but not meaning that it went away in their original language.
What else could they transfer to?
Yeah. So, but this means that synesthetic associations are made in the higher conceptual areas, not just at the sensory levels. Isn't that interesting?
That's really cool.
Now,
holy crap!
Well, Steve, how profound of a difference is the structure of their brain? Like you said earlier, that there's like a hardwiring difference.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And I found other research that found that
fMRIs?
Looking with fMRI studies and other MRI studies, that synesthetes have more gray matter, just total gray matter by volume, than non-synesthete controls.
Ooh.
And that they have novel brain connections that are widely distributed throughout the brain, not just in the sensory area. So the differences exist throughout the brain. So their brains are wired differently. They're wired differently, and it produces this new phenomenon of synesthesia, of combining different types of abstract thought and different types of sensory input. And that now the neuroscientists who are looking at this are hypothesizing that, this is actually maybe telling us a lot about how the brain works, and maybe that we can exploit this to further investigate how the brain is normally wired up, in that the way we make connections, abstract connections in our head, may be a similar phenomenon, right? The way one thing reminds you of something right. else.
So the scientists can treat synesthetes like they were like victims of a stroke, where part of their brain is knocked out and they could see what the deficit is. So here they're seeing, what these guys can do based on their wiring, and then kind of extrapolate to normal brains and learn
more about our brains from what they can do. They're not handicapped. If anything, I would say that...
No, not at all. They're like human 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have a more profound consciousness than us, than normal people.
Yeah, I mean, again, it actually, the word normal doesn't really even apply here. It's really... and I may have actually even used it inadvertently myself previously, but it's probably better to say like non-synesthete controls, not quote unquote normal people, because
right.
the other term that's kind of emerging is neurotypical. So synesthesia is not neurotypical, but what this really gets to is that there's a lot more variation in biology than we really imagine. And that, all this variation is experimenting with new patterns and new abilities, and a lot of them probably don't result in any noticeable difference, or they're neutral. They don't, it's just people are different, right? It's not really possible to say one is more typical than another or better than another. It's just people are different. Well, this is a way that's a little bit more profound, and it may produce a neutral but interesting difference in some people, but sometimes, like with the math genius who can actually do mathematics more quickly because he can combine the shapes of the numbers into a new shape, which is the answer to the equation. That's at least how he reports how he does it.
Right.
There just happens to be this freakish benefit to this novel hardwiring.
Well, yeah, and that's Daniel Tammet. That's the guy that Jay was talking about. And I think he is very interesting in that he does have this, supposedly this incredible ability, as far as anyone can tell. All the tests thus far have shown that he actually does have that ability to see numbers as shapes. Other people do as well, but he's one of the first to have come along who's able to communicate it, because it seems like a lot of people who have his kind of savant abilities have such severe autism, or like he has Asperger's, but he can communicate it. So it seems like it comes with certain disadvantages in a way when it comes to actually communicating with other people. So it's really interesting when scientists can find people who have the ability but aren't hampered in other ways socially, so that they can actually explore it more.
Yeah, so sometimes there are trade-offs, right? And in evolution and biology, there's often trade-offs. But sometimes, this natural evolutionary experimentation hits on something that's a net gain, where there isn't a trade-off, it's just a new ability emerges. So that's, to me, the coolest part. First of all, it's just really cool how what we're learning about synesthesia, but also when you think about what this really means about how nature and biology is experimenting and how new abilities like this can emerge and evolve is awesome, and is also a really good example of what the creationists say just doesn't happen or is extremely unlikely to happen. Again, I think a lot of people who can't quote-unquote imagine how things could evolve have a lack of appreciation for how much variation there really is out there in nature.
Right. Now we just need a very fertile young woman to find crazy math skills incredibly attractive. And go hook up with Daniel Tammet.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, Rebecca. And there's actually been speculation that given the fact that our society is becoming more technological, there actually is, in recent times, the emergence of what some people have called the alpha nerd, right? meaning that the male, and it could actually even be a female too, who succeeds reproductively in and as well as in other ways, because they have mad science or math or engineering skills, and that this may actually, we may actually be seeing that a selective pressures favoring these abilities. You know, some people have gone as far as to say maybe that's why we're perceiving an increase in autism diagnosis. Some guy actually put this forward as a serious hypothesis. We're seeing more autism because engineers are having more kids because they're being selected for in our new technology-driven society.
It certainly seems likely.
It's probable.
I'll say probable.
So Steve, not impossible.
As you were explaining all this to me, I was thinking about how, you know, jokingly, like when are the mutant power is going to evolve? You know, like
right.
But
I think
this counts.
So, this comes really close.
It does. There's something like incredibly powerful about it, and I'm just thinking, you know, how interesting is it to think our biology could just keep going so much more profoundly forward than where it is right now? Like our consciousness could be, you know, and people who experience synesthesia, like I bet if you had a conversation with them, you wouldn't even notice a difference, right?
No.
Like they're just operating with another tool set that we don't have that doesn't really change them in a way that you would think, wow, they're totaled or weird.
Right. No, it's like problems. Some people who have ridiculous music skills. There's stuff going on in their head that's not going on in your head or my head. You don't think that they're weird or anything. They're just really musically adept, for example.
I find that so unbelievably interesting, you know, and I'll never be able – it's like seeing in colors that you can't perceive.
Right.
Like, I want to see it. I want to know what that's like.
What color is ultraviolet?
it's kind of purpley, isn't it?
It is. It's cool because we often think about the future in terms of what new technologies we'll have and how the actual world will look different. But we always – I think we think of it in terms of how we ourselves would perceive that future world. We don't ever really, or I don't ever think of it in terms of the population in the future. Our descendants may actually be physically interacting and experiencing the world in a fundamentally different way than we do now.
Oh, there's no question in my mind. Yeah, exactly. That's how
the idea that, you know, in several thousand years, they'll just be tasting colors and that's that.
Right. You never know. Let's go on to a couple of questions.
Several thousand. Your grandkids would be doing that. All right, let's go.
Question number one comes from Matthew Floritos from New Zealand. And Matthew writes, I realize your show is significantly news-oriented. However, I feel like you're never really talking about how you see the future of skepticism or the future of the movement, if it can be called such, in general. For instance,
we're all going to be tasting colors.
Right. For instance, do you feel that as new generations roll around, society will grow increasingly more skeptical or more favorable towards science? From my perspective, the new media out there, video games in particular, are overwhelmingly skeptical. There are a few religious or kooky games out there. One of the best-selling series in the well-known Grand Theft Auto series, which is, in a word, cynical and takes no prisoners in pushing a skeptical message, making a South Park-esque mockery of religion and pseudoscience. Then, of course, there are many science-based games such as Half-Life, which you have, in fact, mentioned on your show before in relation to the Coast to Coast hoax, where somebody pretended to be the game's protagonist. Looking at this, is it too hopeful to say that Western society will grow increasingly more skeptical as the years pass? Well, that's a very interesting question. We actually have touched upon this in the past. I know when we interviewed Paul Kurtz, and you can go back and look at that interview, we discussed this very question. This is a question that I asked of Paul. But I don't know that if we've discussed it among the rogues. So what would you guys say? What's your bottom line take on this question? Can we hope that society is going to get more skeptical in the future?
Well, I think the first question is, have we? You know, what do the statistics tell us? I'd say that we have, right? I think that our society has grown a stronger foundation of rational thinking, even though it may have slipped a little bit here and there. I think our science has progressed a great deal. I think especially with the advent of the internet, I mean, the ability to get information is so much more profound now than it ever was. But, you know, has the number of people that believe in woo gone down? I don't think so, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think we have answered this question a few times because it comes up often at live shows. And I always say that yeah, I'm very optimistic. And I don't think it's necessarily about the number of people who believe in weird things, but the fact that we seem to be, as time goes on, neutering superstitions and myths and turning them into from something dangerous into something that's just a pastime for the wealthy. You know, I think there's obviously a tremendous amount of work to go when it comes to dangerous pseudoscience and superstition. But in general, I think that we're doing okay. And I think that science is continuing to grow, or our scientific knowledge, I should say, is growing. And it will continue to grow into the foreseeable future. So, yeah, I give us thumbs up.
You know, I could see it go both ways. Neither one would surprise me. I think skepticism has grown by leaps and bounds in the past 20 years or so. But I think irrational beliefs have also grown. Maybe not quite as much. It's hard to say. But if I look into the future, I could see, you know, science really and critical thinking and skepticism really coming to the fore and doing really well in a way that would make us very, very happy. You know, never getting rid of a superstitious belief, but, you know, marginalizing it to a degree that we haven't seen, but maybe ever. But then the other side of me is thinking, you know, I could just see it totally going nuts and people totally descending into superstition. And as science gets more and more complicated and technological, I could see people just like giving up on it, be like, I can't understand that, and treating it as like a religion, that it's just so complicated. You have your techno priests that nobody can understand. Who knows if they're telling the truth, type of thing. And I could see that too. So I don't know what the hell to expect.
What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of in Bob's camp in that, depending on how you look at it, you see all kinds of trends overlapping. I think if you take a long view, that it seems as if there's been a general trend towards less superstition, more rationality, just in human civilization. And I'm hoping that that long-term trend holds up. Superimposed upon that, I think there's a shorter-term cyclical trend where pseudosciences come and go, not only individually, but just in general. And I think there's always going to be a battle to fight. There's always going to be, you know, we may marginalize one pseudoscience and two others will take its place and we'll have to deal with them as well. So the human nature will, and the need for this sense of transcendence, this need to believe in something, and that, you know, all the pitfalls that we all talk about, those are not changing, or at least not quickly. Again, maybe we'll evolve into a more rational species in a few thousand years. But at least for the foreseeable future, people are people, and we're going to have to deal with the, you know, inherent irrationality, I think, of our species. Also, if you look at it from another point of view, if you look at the different cultures around the world, some cultures are much more rational than others, and some cultures are so thoroughly steeped in pseudoscience or superstition, that what that tells me is that there's the potential for that to happen to just about any culture, that they could descend and really get overwhelmed with superstition. And I don't think that is impossible, you know. So while I think the long-term trends are hopeful, I think there's always going to be these shorter-term trends, and we're always going to have something to combat. And without a group promoting science and trying to keep science connected to the public and to pop culture in general, that there is the risk of, like what Bob says, is that science becomes completely detached from popular culture and becomes almost the equivalent of a priesthood. And we could even end up with an incredibly regressive, superstitious population.
Well, yeah, let's take a long-term stab here and just throw some ideas down real quick. Like, let's say that in a couple of hundred years, we get to the point where we're absolutely evolving ourselves, right? Where we're choosing to make changes in our consciousness, and we're merging with machines, yeah, you know, computers or whatever.
Then all bets are off, I think.
Yeah. At that point, the reality is going to become very blurred. We won't even be sharing the same reality anymore. And then
reality is going to be what you make it.
Yeah.
So people could be living in their own little virtual worlds, and it could be whatever they want.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, they already are. They don't really need the extra help.
Let's do one more question before we go on to our interview. This one comes from Damon McLean from Mill Valley, California. And Damon writes, What would happen if a person was standing in the path of a proton in the Large Hadron Collider?
Yeah, I'm really happy that we're answering this question, because as soon as I read that, I thought, man, I have no idea, and I really want to know the answer to that.
My first thought when I thought of this question, this is a really fun question, was that the magnets are cooled by liquid helium, and you've got some intense magnetic fields going on that would definitely wreak some havoc with your life form readings. So I think you might be dead before the proton hits you. But I assume you meant that, to ignore that kind of stuff, what kind of kinetic energy would one of the billions of protons?
Yeah, or just they shoot the proton out of the collider and into you.
Well, from what I could figure out, the LHC will hopefully at some point, maybe in 2011, reach their limit of 7 TeV or trillion electron volts, and that kind of energy will accelerate protons up to 99.999991% of the speed of light. So pretty damn fast. Physicist Brian Cox, I found a quote from him. He says that the total energy of the beam would be like a battleship moving at several miles per hour. Now, I don't know what that would do to you. It would be cool, but it would not be pretty. But that's a whole bunch of protons. One proton, though, wouldn't be too bad from what I could gather. I found a frequently asked question website at CERN, and they're quoted here as saying that each particle accelerated in the LHC carries an amount of energy equivalent to that of a flying mosquito. So, Damon, I think that would be your answer right there. Essentially, it's equivalent to the impact of a flying mosquito hitting you. So not too bad. And I wanted to do some verification of this, so I converted 7 trillion electron volts to ergs. An erg is a unit of energy that's about equal to the force of a falling raindrop. And I plugged in 7 TeV, and it came out that that would equal to 11 ergs or 11 raindrops. So I guess that's roughly equivalent to a flying mosquito, maybe.
Yeah, but Bob, that would all be concentrated into one proton, not spread out over a mosquito.
I thought about that, Steve. Why, yeah, I wonder what that would do.
Just tear right through you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a single proton, unless it hits a DNA molecule and mutates it into a cancer cell, right, then you probably don't have anything to fear from a single proton. But also, Bob, aren't protons passing through us right now? Just from,
yeah, aren't we being bombarded nonstop from the protons,
cosmic rays and stuff? Not many, but I mean, occasionally.
Anything going through you now, if they're cosmic rays, the cosmic rays are pretty much eaten up by the atmosphere. By the time they get down here, they're pretty, you know, attenuated, and they've been blasted into subparticles and types of things. There's nothing like these protons reaching us down here.
I just happened to have been backstage with Brian Cox.
Oh, you rock.
And it was at Robin Ince's show, 9 Lessons for Godless People, which was just outrageously amazing. And anybody who's near London next year has to go. So I was backstage with Brian, and I was also with Neil Denny, who does Little Atoms. And as you guys know, Neil and I sometimes collaborate on interviews. So we decided to ask Brian a few questions. And I unfortunately hadn't read this question from our listener prior to this, or I would have asked him directly. But I did ask him something sort of similar, which was, what would happen if you put 2 kittens in the LHC and fired them at each other? So this is what he had to say.
I was just having this conversation with someone about the particle collider, and we had this question about what would happen if you put a kitten in and a kitten in the other side, and then you fired them at high speeds.
If you got them traveling at 99.999999% speed of light, which is the speed of the protons, which would take a lot more energy, so you couldn't. But if you did, then they would weigh 7,000 times more. Or they would be 7,000 times more massive, for the pedants, those people who don't like astrology on Monkey. Pedants, they'd be 7,000 times more massive, and time would pass 7,000 times more slowly for the kittens relative to the... So they would live 7,000 times as long as their twin kitten stood there next to the detector watching them go around the ring.
So you would have like a perma-kitten of sorts.
Yeah, it would live 7,000 times longer and be 7,000 times heavier.
How fast? How fast could a kitten go in the particle collider?
Very, very slowly. It wouldn't even be able to move a kitten, because it can only move, you know, it can only move a proton at 99.999999% speed of light. If you think how many protons are in a kitten, Well, remember Avogadro's number, 6 × 10², innit? And so I don't know many moles of hydrogen and water and fat there are in a kitten, but someone can work that out. And so it is a lot, right? So there's a lot of protons in a kitten.
It would have to be a homeopathic kitten.
Infinitely diluted. Yeah, don't mention homeopathy, because we're getting tweets again from people.
I just want to get you in trouble.
I don't want to know.
Thanks, Brian.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, and before we move on, just to note that the full interview with Brian, as well as interviews with a lot of other British comedians and scientists, is on Little Adams, and it will be going up on the Skeptic podcast soon.
Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Michael Spector. Michael, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Michael is a New Yorker staff writer since 1998 and is the author of the book Denialism, How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. Now, Michael, reading through this book, I definitely had the notion that this was a fairly hardcore skeptical book. Have you considered yourself to be a skeptic?
Well, possibly not in the word skeptic, but if you defined it, I probably would fit into the definition. I'm just someone who has seen these issues grow over time, and it's concerned me and concerns me greatly now.
And was there one particular issue? I mean, you wrote about several things in the book, and we'll touch on a couple of them, but was there one that really motivated you to write this book more than the others?
I don't think so. I think what happened was about a decade ago, I wrote a short thing about some sort of vaccine lunacy, and I didn't know very much about the issue at the time, and I just thought these were people who, you know, had buried their head in the sand for some understandable but mostly not understandable reasons, and they represented a small group of people, and I moved on. And then I, soon after that, wrote a piece about genetically modified food, mostly in Europe, and I was struck and continue to be struck, dumbstruck, by the response to it and the growth of this sort of religion of organics. And that in vitamin worship, it just all seemed to add up to this sort of common thread of wanting to run away from data.
So you saw that as a pattern across these disparate issues.
I did, and I saw other issues too, some of which I didn't even write about. I've actually been criticized for one of which is creationism. Mm-hmm. I went down to the Creation Museum. I thought I would write about it, but I just sort of felt that if people want to believe their ancestors rode around on the back of dinosaurs, I don't really think that I can have much of a useful conversation with them. I really wanted to write about things that maybe we could argue about with some value, and I didn't see that, or AIDS denialism, which I've written about quite a bit, or even climate change as falling into that category.
So how would you define denialism?
Well, to me, denialism isn't so different from denial. I mean, you know, people face terrible things all the time, and their first reaction is often to pretend they don't exist. And I think on an individual level, that's totally understandable, and it might even be healthy if it's brief, as long as people come out of it. But when we do it as a society or as a segment of society, that to me is denialism, and that is dangerous. And I think one of the things that I believe is that the consequences of those actions are far more significant than maybe some people suggest they are.
Did you try to focus on those issues that you felt had big consequences?
Yes, and I also guess I tried to focus on issues that I thought people didn't focus on. I mean, for instance, climate change has bigger consequences than any issue I can think of. I didn't focus on that because I just thought that the data there was so overwhelming, I wasn't really sure I could make a contribution. I mean, in my last chapter, I write about synthetic biology, which is an attempt to look at some solutions to climate change. But I mostly wanted to look at issues that I thought maybe were amenable to having people sit down and say, whoa, what's going on here? You know, I kind of feel with some of these issues, the sides are so hardened and so religious that it's difficult to have a conversation.
And why do you think that is? Because obviously if we're talking about creationism, it's easy to see why the creationists are being religious, because that's the ideology from which creationism is coming. But when we're talking about organic foods, let's talk about organic foods for a while. Why has that been so politicized and emotionalized when you would think that would be something that would be driven, that should be driven by the science?
Well, I think when I talk about organic food with people and they start getting upset, what I end up usually hearing is anger about two things. One is the corporate ownership of seeds, and the other is the excessive use of pesticides and chemicals. Now, we can talk about the corporate ownership of seeds. I don't think the situation is quite what many people do think, but that is not science. That is a policy issue. And what I'm trying to do is divorce the science from the way it's used. I think that can be done intellectually. I know it can't be done in life. But if we don't like the way a technology is used, we can change that. People look at organics and they think, here is a safer, cleaner approach to life at a time when we know there are a lot of problems. We know that the food supply is often contaminated, and we know that we're eating badly and that the diseases of excess are our biggest diseases in this country. But what people don't seem to realize is that there are other countries, and 1 billion people go to bed hungry every night, and I'm much more concerned about them, frankly, than I am about Americans.
So you think that people start with a policy position based upon their political ideology, and then they want the science to fit their policy?
Yes, I do think that. And I also think that when it comes to food, most people start from a sort of gut feeling of, I want to protect my family, I want to protect myself, I want to do what's right. I think most people who care about organic food care about the earth. It's not that they don't. I mean, I don't talk about genetically modified food in the book because all food we eat is genetically modified. I talk about genetically engineered food. And yeah, there's a difference between shooting something around it with a plant gene gun and modifying something over generations. But the results so far have been promising, and over the next few years, there are going to be some really exciting products, and I don't want to see those things prevented from coming online in the places where they're needed because some people in Iowa don't like the idea of it.
So on the one hand, it's maybe the human need for simplicity. Everything has got to be in line with their ideology, including the science. But you talk also in the book about the fact that there is some deep-seated mistrust of the institutions of science, some of it deserved. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I mean, I think some of denialism is a response to, you know, when I was growing up, we were told that science would cure all diseases and hunger and would fix water and take salt out of it if we were running out. We would solve all problems with technology. And, you know, while I will argue that we've solved a lot of them and we're going to solve a lot more, it is also true that we've caused a lot of harm. We've made a lot of mistakes, and everybody knows it. People know about Chernobyl. They know about Three Mile Island. They know about Karen Ann Quinlan, and they're anxious. They look at the healthcare system, and they see that it sucks in any number of ways. And they look at our government, and they think, can we just believe someone when they say something? And I don't think anyone should. You know, you talk about being a skeptic. I don't think anyone should believe anybody when they're just told take a pill or take a shot. But there's data out there. And what concerns me is that when people look at the data, especially overwhelming data, it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, we have outbreaks of mumps now in New York. I mean, this is just craziness.
So it seems like some of it is a backlash from the 1950s sort of utopia of science, and now people are disillusioned that it's complicated. It also has risks, and it can also be abused. So maybe they're overreacting a little bit to that fact.
I think that's exactly true. I also think, let's face it, we have oversold science a bit. I mean, when I say we, I mean scientists, I mean government officials, and I mean people who do what I do for a living, including probably me. We tend to write stories about how things are going to solve problems. And they may solve problems, but the timeline is usually much longer than you might guess from looking at a newspaper article, and people get frustrated.
Where's the jetpacks?
Where is the jetpack? I want that damn thing. But here's the thing. We're solving some of these problems, but people don't have perspective. I mean, this is one thing I wrote about Vioxx in the book, and one reason I did so was because that was a very complicated issue to me, because on the one hand, Merck did a terrible thing, and they lied, and they propagated a falsehood on the American people, and many people died. On the other hand, I have to say, and I have been beat up by this in the press, that drug should be on the market today, under different circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, you made an interesting point that, I mean, we have other drugs on the market that just have a, what we call a black box warning. It's like, you don't use it under these circumstances, or you have to monitor patients for in certain ways. These are the risks. If you use it properly, you can still eke the benefit out of this drug as long as you take the risks into account. Vioxx could have gone that way, except for the fact that Merck kind of screwed themselves by doing what they did.
They screwed themselves, they screwed people, but also we live in a country where, and I'm not a physician, but I believe it's true that once a drug is approved, a doctor can pretty much prescribe it the way he or she sees fit. Now, we should have some system in this country for being able to say, you're obese, you have diabetes, you have a history of heart disease, you have cholesterol problems, this drug is dangerous for you, but for the millions of others, you know, the risk, we take a risk in everything we do every day, everything. Get in a car, get in an elevator, whatever it is, there's a risk. Yeah, people never look at the both sides of it. They, you know, it's if it's a fraction, they don't look at the numerator and the denominator. They look at one side, and I have to say it drives me nuts.
Yeah, that's a common problem that we encounter as well. People will consider only the risks, not the risk versus the benefit.
I mean, you're completely right. I mean, I hate to beat up on this guy. I have a bit, but Leonard Lopate, who's a very smart NPR interview. I had him on. He had me on the show. I'd been on the show a few times, and it's always pleasant. He has a child with autism, and he's absolutely convinced it was a result of a vaccine.
Right.
And it's very difficult to say to a person who's got a child who's really in trouble, because I've seen it, and it's painful. Oh, you're wrong. You're wrong about your kid. And in fact, that vaccine actually came 3 months after you thought it did, and you're conflating a few things, and we've done tests with millions of people. I totally understand why that is not a satisfying answer to a person who has to go home at night and deal with something so painful. Nonetheless, if we don't use the data, if we don't rely on the facts, I really don't know what we can rely on.
I mean, obviously, I agree with that, and I encounter that same situation myself. I try very hard, and we generally do. When an individual is making a claim about their own life, we try not to get into that. But if we just want to back up, we want to talk about the data, as it were, the science.
Right.
You know, not you don't want to get involved with debunking someone's personal feelings about an experience that they personally had or their own child. It's a no-win situation.
I mean, you know this better than me, but I think what happens is that people are programmed, and understandably so, to respond to the things in their own environment or their cousin's cousin who got sick or who felt better after he started taking echinacea or whatever it is. And it's very difficult to throw a stack of statistics at someone when they're absolutely convinced of a personal belief. And that's just something that in some ways is human nature, but it also has a little bit to do with education, I think.
Mm-hmm. So how do we combat it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was on a radio show in San Francisco, and some woman got on and said, you have said that 13 million Americans have received the H1N1 vaccine, and there hasn't been one clear death as a result. And that's completely untrue, because the CDC released data saying that, 13 or 15 people have died in the 2 months. Well, we could take 13 or 15 million people and tell them to go down to the corner store and buy a newspaper, and 15 of them would die too, and there'd be lots of divorces and miscarriages. And the divorce rate wouldn't go up or down as a result of the vaccine, but in any large group, these things happen. And people don't, they're just not able to sort of extrapolate or make that connection, and it's terrifying to me, because if we're, I just feel, I don't want to overemphasize the science. I'm going to be 55 soon, and I feel pretty healthy, and hopefully I am. I'm probably going to live twice as long as my great-great-grandparents, twice as long. It's not coincidence. It's science.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to not forget that.
So it sounds like you're saying part of the problem is the disappointment over the benefits of science being oversold. Part of the problem is a lack of trust, sometimes based on paranoia, sometimes based on some actual real betrayal of that trust, like Vioxx. And also, there's this disconnect between the public understanding of science and the practice of science. We tend to listen more to anecdotes and stories, not so much data on a page. And that's probably largely a fault of education. Or would you blame the media for that as well?
Oh, the media is never at fault. Yeah, of course. Yeah, and the media is often at fault. I think there's something else going on here, which is a bigger and more difficult issue, which is, I don't know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, if you were sitting in a room, you'd probably know how all the things around you worked. Now, I'm not a dumb guy, but I don't exactly know the technical reasons that we're able to have a conference call and someone from London is on it. I don't know how my internet works exactly, and I don't even know how my carburetor works. And that's okay with me. But I think more and more people are surrounded in their world by things they need to rely on but don't understand. And the accretion of all that is it makes them uncomfortable. And so what you see, and you see this with drugs, they run into a vitamin store. Because big pharma's bad and the healthcare system is bad and everything's confusing and it's not curing them. So let's buy in, you know, a vitamin complex or an antioxidant because it just seems natural. And I can understand that desire. It's just that we have to remember that natural is not necessarily good. In fact, it doesn't really mean anything.
Right. So there's also a desire to grab control. Is what you're saying.
I think so. I mean, I think it's a natural thing. I don't think it's a bad thing, but I just think that one way we could grab control is to understand science a little bit better than we do.
Right, right. And I think that may be, that's an interesting insight. And you know, my dealings with, say, the anti-vaccination movement and similar denialist movements, what I feel is that they are trying to have a sense of control over the world, over their lives, by thinking that they've seen the man behind the curtain, right? That they understand the conspiracy. Whereas, like, you and I may be trying to grapple with our complex world by understanding the science. And there's a fundamental difference in process going on. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, I do. But I'm also worried about another thing. You said the word conspiracy. Why? When did, and this is particularly true of progressives in this country, when did progressive and reactionary become synonymous? Because I see a lot, you know, the anti-vaccine people or even some people who are anxious about vaccines are often well-educated. I mean, I have a college classmate who saw me on a TV show and she emailed me and said there's no way she was going to be vaccinating her kid against polio because we don't have it. And we don't have polio right now in this country, and I really hope we never do, but we have it in the world. And the idea that a virus can't return, can't spread, you know, it's only been a generation since our parents were deathly petrified that we'd all become crippled or killed by polio. But we've been so good at abolishing them and banishing them that people don't even know. They don't know what measles is. 200,000 people died of measles last year in the world, but Americans don't know, and most of their pediatricians don't know because we haven't seen it in a long time. And it's very difficult to convince people these are serious threats.
Yeah, the vaccines have been victims now of their own success.
And they've been remarkably successful.
And I have some colleagues who have argued that we really won't get a handle on the anti-vaccine movement until there's the serious return of some vaccine-preventable illnesses. And again, it sort of strikes the fear into the population. Do you think
it's already starting, right?
That may be true. It's really scary. I mean, it's just sad to see mumps outbreaks. And, you know, Britain and America and to some degree Europe are the only places where measles vaccination rates are declining. You know, in Africa, the rest of the world, they're all rising and we're getting rid of measles more and more. And the idea that in this great country, our vaccination rates are worse now than they were ever in the last 20 years is, it's really unbelievable.
So does science have a PR problem?
Yes, we do. We have a terrible PR problem. And we are in many ways responsible. And when I say we, I mean scientists, scientific organizations in the press, because I do think the overselling is a problem. I think arrogance is also a problem, because we often portray science as the truth. And if you're not on board with the truth, then somehow you're misbegotten. And I think that pisses people off, and maybe rightly so. You know, they don't want to be talked down to. They don't want to be told that they don't get it and they ought to get in line and do what they're told. But I think there's been a lot of that. And I think that's part of the problem, too.
Yeah, we certainly encounter that because as science gets more complicated, as you were saying, not only are we surrounded by devices we don't understand, but the science that's happening on the cutting edge is inaccessible to everyone but the experts in that field. So when people are told, well, this is what the experts believe, you know, the experts are relatively sure that the Earth is warming and humans are causing it, you don't have to understand the nitty-gritty details. Don't worry about it. Just trust us. That violates, especially in America, I think that sort of violates our sense of democracy and fairness and self-empowerment. So doesn't it seem natural that people would say, no, forget that. I don't trust the scientists. I want to make up my own mind.
Yes, it does. And it also, I mean, there's another aspect here, and that is, A, I think we don't trust authority as much as we used to. In 1947, if a drug company said, stand on your head, swallow this, and run around the block three times, and you'll feel better, everyone would do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's right that everyone would do it, but there was a different profile then. It's been eroded, and it's not just because of science. I mean, it's Watergate. It's everything. We've grown up to be a country that's skeptical of our leaders. A lot of that is good. I mean, I'm, as I guess all of you are, a true believer in skepticism. But skepticism is just, I think, rigorous doubt and questioning. But when you make the questions and you satisfy yourself with the answers, you got to move on.
Right, right. But it makes it so that, especially now with the internet, it's everyone's a citizen scientist, right? Regardless of their education. And maybe the problem is that people think that they are... That they understand more science than they really do, or they don't understand the gulf between where their level of knowledge is and where the experts in the field are.
They don't even know who the experts are. And that's part of the problem. They're taking these people as experts who are not experts. Just go to their website and buy their book, and now they're experts.
You need to get to a certain level of expertise before you understand what you don't know. So if you have people who don't really understand even the nuts and bolts of science, they just have no idea, you know, where the science really is.
But I really do think that that's a tremendous failing of our education system now, and it's getting critical. You know, if you look at international science tests for high school kids, we're kind of flailing about. If you know, we're where we were 15 years ago in China, India, Hong Kong, Singapore. All those places are rocketing upward, and I think we have this sort of feeling that we're the great technologically supreme nation, and therefore we will remain that way. But there's just endless examples in history of people losing their foothold on supremacy for just that reason. And you know, I have a teenage daughter, and she goes to a good school and she takes physics and chemistry. And that stuff's fine. I would rather, since I don't think she will be a scientist, I'd rather trade in physics for statistics. I think if there's one course they should all take, it's some sort of statistics that would let people evaluate the sort of common choices and risks they face all the time. But very few schools offer that.
It's worse even in issues, some that you didn't even cover. Like for me personally, it's the alternative medicine issue. I mean, I've frequently now put in the position where I'm having to defend the very notion that medicine should be based on good science.
Well, you know, it's funny because in my book, I kind of trash Andrew Weil as viciously as I'm capable of doing so. And some people, including Charlie Rose, that has not aired, but it will. Kind of went to town on that. But it seems to me that it's so clear. It's so clear. The data is so amazing, and it keeps getting to be more amazing that sort of antioxidant pills, vitamin pills, it's all either useless or sometimes even dangerous. Mm-hmm. And by it's all, I know there are vitamins. I take vitamin D. I mean, there are vitamins that work for people and that they ought to take. But it's, you could go into any vitamin store in this country and basically take 97% of the products off the shelf and throw them into the ocean. And the only thing that would happen that would be bad is that it would pollute the ocean.
Right, right.
I mean, I agree with you. It's very, very disturbing. But again, here's an interesting political issue about that. Because there you see the marriage of the sort of countercultural left and the right wing. You see the Orrin Hatches of the world, and you see the sort of, you know, intellectual progeny of the hippies of the 60s saying, you know, give me the thing, give me those vitamins.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Michael, I have news for you. You are a skeptic. I think that's the kind
of, I'm happy to be called one. I have no problem with that.
I know. I mean, I know what you're saying. You're not someone who's tied into the formal skeptical movement, and maybe you're not exactly sure how we define ourselves, but that's basically what skepticism is. It's just rigorous, as you say, it's rigorous doubt. It's putting the science first above ideology or beliefs. That's it.
Well, that's what I believe in. And as you know, I mean, I did cite you guys in my book.
I do know that, yeah. You quoted science-based medicine, and
it's just so obvious that has been so fruitful. Relying, trying something out, observing whether it works, trying to fix it, repeating it. That has been such a remarkably effective way of doing business these last few hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to have to fight a battle. You know, I happen to know, for weird reasons, some of the people who run the U.S. vaccine program. They spend half their time going around the country trying to convince people that vaccines are good. Now, I'd like them to spend more time developing better vaccines and maybe growing vaccines in something other than eggs the way we did in 1947. You know, I'd like them to focus on the future, not the past, but they have no choice.
Yeah, it's incredibly wasteful. You know, pseudoscience and anti-science ultimately just wastes a lot of time and energy and resources.
I know. I agree with you.
Well, we really appreciate you spending some time with us, Michael, and the book is highly recommended, Denialism.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm very happy to have spoken
with
you guys.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Michael.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Mm-hmm.
So ready.
Okay, we have a theme this week.
Uh-huh.
The theme is parasites.
I hate themes and I hate parasites.
I'm going to describe for you three parasites. Two are real and one is made up.
Interesting.
You have to tell me which one's the fake.
Uh-huh.
Would a Kato Kaelin joke be too
non-topical? Go for it.
All right, here we go. Parasite number one. The spine tick attaches to the base of a vertebrate's spine where it digs down through the meninges to feed off the glucose in spinal fluid rather than blood. Parasite number two. Simithoa exigua is a fish parasite that eats the tongues of fish down to a nub, then latches onto that nub, living in the fish's mouth as a replacement tongue. And parasite number three, Sacculina carcini, is a crab parasite that enters into the shell of a crab, then its root-like extensions enter the crab's organs and nervous system. The crab is then helpless as the parasite lives out its life cycle in the crab's shell. Bob, go first.
So we all know that parasites, there's some wacky parasites out there, so I guess none of these are totally nuts. But got the spine tick feeding off glucose. I would think that's pretty far for a tick to dig. Normally a tick probably digs half a body length maybe inside, you know, with his proboscis or whatever that was called. I guess it's possible that it could dig 2-3 body lengths to get to this stuff, but that seems a little odd to me. Then you've got this fish parasite eating tongues. Now, the first thing I think of when I think of that is that how is the fish – is it hard for the fish to feed while its tongue is being eaten away? And wouldn't that just kill the host and prevent the parasite from living anymore? So that doesn't sound too right to me. Then you've got this Sacculina crab parasite. So, Steve, are you saying that this parasite takes over the crab and just starts kind of like stealing a car and driving a hot rod for the rest of its life in this crab shell?
Yes.
Oh, man. That's so freaky bizarre that you'd think somebody – I would have encountered that at some point. Somebody would have said, hey, this parasite completely takes over a crab. And then it does parasite things instead of crab things. I wonder what it does differently. Does it mate?
Calls up all its friends, the crab's cell phone.
How about mating? How would it know to make a pass at a crab?
Buys hot tubs.
He'd be making parasite moves, not crab moves. Crap. You got to end it this year for me, Steve, with a loss, you bastard. I would think. Oh, yeah, here's another thing. How about eating? If this thing takes control of a crab, how does it really know even how to eat? And then wouldn't the crab just die? All right, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
The spine tick attaches itself to the base of a vertebrate spine. I don't believe that at all. I think that's total BS. The reason why is if it does that, it could potentially damage its host. And if it kills its host, it's defeating the idea of being a parasite. So I'm going to say that that's the fake.
Okay, Rebecca?
Okay. When you said the topic, and Jay said he hates parasites, and I agreed, I was actually lying. I friggin' love parasites. because I think they're the coolest thing ever. And so that's why I actually know. I think I've got this one. Sacculina, the crab parasite. I believe that that is a barnacle, a mind control barnacle, and it's red. So that one definitely exists. And I'm pretty sure I've heard the tongue thing before. I'm not positive, but that one does ring a bell. And once you hear something like parasite eats the tongue and replaces the tongue, you can't unhear it. So,
that's so goddamn true.
Which brings us to the spine tick. I think Bob hit the nail on the head there. Ticks don't go down that deep. And that's first of all. And second of all, the thing that really tips your hand, Steve, is saying something so sloppy like that it attacks the vertebrate spine. Who says that? As opposed to the invertebrate spine? Really, Steve? That one's fiction. You made that up and you got sloppy.
So you all agree with the tongue parasite that...
Yeah.
The fish parasite eats the tongue down to the nub, then latches onto the nub and lives out the fish's, living in the fish's mouth as a replacement tongue. You all think that one's real, and that one is science.
Wow.
Yay, yeah. Tongue parasite.
That's so, you know, these parasites, why do they all have to do, like, incredibly weird shit? Parasites are so bizarrely disgusting.
These aren't the most evil ones either. There are ones that make these look like pikers. Right, Steve?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I didn't want to use ones that we've talked about before. Yeah, like, you know, I didn't use the one where the parasite makes the ants climb up to the top of grass so that they can be easier to eat by birds, you know.
Yeah.
Those are fun, but we've talked about that one. This one, you guys have to see the pictures of this one. I mean, it's just this giant parasite in the mouth of a fish where its tongue should be, just sitting there. But, you know, the fish apparently still function fine with the fake tongue, the parasite tongue.
Yeah, except that in their head they're screaming. You know, like, give me a break. Yeah, the fish are fine.
No. They're just thinking. They're just thinking, you know.
I wish I had hands.
They're thinking the food around this section of the sea is awful bland all of a sudden.
No, they're thinking.
It's horrific.
Yeah, I got the tongue upgrade.
No, they're not, Bob.
No, the girlfriends are.
Right.
Is there anyone, I mean, legitimately, is there any creature that has a parasite that's okay with it?
Jay, I just made the dirtiest joke, and you didn't even respond.
I didn't hear it. What did you say?
Nothing. It's too late. Go on. You'll have to listen
to the show. Do punk fish, like, go out of their way to get these parasitic tongues?
Right. It's the new tongue ring. New tongue stuff. Tongue stud.
Let's go back to number one. The spine tick attaches to the base of a vertebrate spine where it digs down through the meninges to feed off the glucose in spinal fluid rather than blood. Jay and Rebecca, you think this one is the fiction. Bob, you bought this one, and this one is the fiction.
Which one was?
The spine tick is the fiction.
Of course it's fiction.
And saying a vertebrate spine is not sloppy.
That is sloppy.
It is
could be the vertebrate skull.
It's implied.
They will do it to any vertebrate.
It's implied. Spine.
It's ridiculous.
Vertebrate.
So the biggest problem with this is that ticks are surface parasites. So it would be hard to get down deep. But it's not inconceivable. I mean, it's a slight variation to their typical behavior. Again, there's lots of variation in nature.
Yeah, but Steve, attacking the spine, does that happen?
What's the problem with this? Rather than
the spinal fluid.
Because it could cripple their host.
No, just the fluid, Jay. You go through the dura, you start sucking out the sweet, sweet spinal fluid inside.
Steve, you know
Steve's
this as
just
well as
angry
anyone.
That we
you nicked the freaking
out.
Spinal cord.
Jay,
and
not
cooked.
The cord. You don't have to go anywhere near the cord. You have a sack of fluid at the base of your spine.
No, I
yes,
don't.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't have a sack of fluid in my
you
back.
He doesn't have a
no,
spine.
Yes, you do.
I don't.
We thank stick you, needles in it all the time and draw
move
out
along,
fluid.
While you're
move
sleeping.
I don't have a sack of anything except one. But other than that one, I don't have any sack situation.
You only have
fluid
one?
Or anything anywhere.
Base of your spine is a sack of spinal fluid. You can
no,
stick a needle
you.
In there and drain off fluid without getting it anywhere near the spinal cord.
Yes, thank you.
Anyway, sir. Made up.
Made up. Fiction. Which means that The Sacculina one is a crab parasite that enters into the shell of a crab, then its root-like extensions enter the crab's organs and nervous system. The crab is then helpless as the parasite lives out its life cycle in the crab shell. Is science.
That's right. I know my parasites, man.
Yeah, so it takes over the crab, Bob. It does joyride the crab, and it makes
it
the...
It turns into like a marionette.
Yeah, basically.
It knows
marionette.
How to eat.
That's
it
horrible.
Knows... How to defecate.
Well,
it kind of
allows the crab to do basic things like that.
Oh, really? Really?
It will make the crab do its own mating dance so that it can mate
its own
with
bidding.
Other parasites.
Really?
Other Sacculina. It sticks out like its head out from the crab shell.
And says, woohoo! Woohoo!
To attract
hey,
a
ladies.
Mate. He's like, yeah, look what
I
got.
Check out my new digs.
It's like a guy in a sports car, right? He sticks
or
his
a mecha
out.
Suit.
Yeah, right, right.
Steve, do I have such an insane aversion to parasites naturally? Like,
yeah, I think disgust with things like that is totally hardwired. Some other parasites that came across the filariasis, or the filarial worm. This one's disgusting. This gives you the elephantiasis. It blocks up your lymphatic drainage, and you get massive limbs. You guys, one that's interesting is screwworms, which reminded me of the boar worms from Flash Gordon. They're
not the boar.
They're basically boar worms. You put them on living tissue, and they bore down, you know, into the living flesh and eat it. And if you touch them, they bore even deeper. They can enter through the navel or the
holy
nasal
crap.
They talked about this one site where they're going over a bunch of like the most interesting parasites. They went over the candiru, which we talked about. The fish that crawls up your willy.
Yep.
Willy. Yeah. Willy.
The insane snail parasite that turns snails into zombies. The acanthamoeba. I remember this one from medical school. The one that crawls in your eye.
No, they don't do that.
Oh, come on. It's just an amoeba.
And, they can't cause blindness, though, if you don't treat it. Because it will cloud up your cornea. Pretty neat. Yeah, parasites are cool.
Ish.
But you got to see this picture of the fish with this parasite sticking out of its mouth.
I've seen it and I can't unsee it.
Wow, what a strategy, you know, just I'm going to live inside the mouth of something that eats a lot of good stuff so I can get first dibs on anything that it eats.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Whatever works.
Yeah, right.
You know. Well, Evan sent in the Who's That Noisy segment. Since he couldn't make it, he did record it and send it in. So let's play that, and then we'll go to the quote of the week.
Hi, everyone. Evan here. Sorry I couldn't be around for the show, but I am here to reveal the answer to Who's That Noisy. Here it is again for those of you who missed it last week. That music was recorded by Voyager 1 and 2 as they crossed paths with Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune. Now, they weren't captured with a microphone, because audible sound obviously cannot travel through space, so Voyager was listening to electromagnetic waves around the planets and moons, and the waves were produced by space phenomena like the planet's magnetospheres interacting with the sun's radiation. And they were released in the 1990s as part of the Voyager recording, Symphonies of the Planets. And the first person to guess correctly this week was from the message boards. ZV470 is his designation. Was the first one to guess it correctly. So congratulations, ZV470. And a thank you also goes out to Chris Moffitt of Washington, who sent in this Who's That Noisy. Thank you, Chris. And now, here's this week's Who's That Noisy.
Thanks for that, Evan. Jay, can you please read us the quote of the week?
Yes, I will. Hold on.
This was a quote that was painstakingly found for me by Caroline Gale. And it is a quote by George Bernard Shaw. "The power of accurate observation is commonly called cynicism by those who have not got it." George Bernard Shaw!
Georgie.
That's a good quote.
Thanks, Caroline.
Caroline spent a half an hour looking up that quote for me. Thank you, Caroline.
I have a thingy announcement. Yes. On January 8th, it's a Friday, the Boston Skeptics are hosting a very special event. The event is called How to Have More Sex with Richard Wiseman. You can parse that sentence any way you'd like, but you can be sure that it's going to be a very good time. It's going to be at the Brattle Theater in Harvard Square, and tickets will be cheap. I'm not sure how much yet, but they'll be going on sale very soon through the Brattle's website, and it's going to be a fantastic time. He's going to come and do a whole show thingy starting at 10 p.m., so, you know, it's for after the kids go to bed. And then he'll also be doing a book signing for his new book, 59 Seconds.
Excellent.
So be there.
And next week is our Decade in Review show.
Wow.
We're not only going to go over 2009, but we're going to talk about
Decade.
The last 10 years of science, skepticism, and the paranormal and all that stuff.
I can barely remember the last
one. Oh, man. Yeah. This one's...
And we are absolutely bound to disappoint you.
I would say that. So thanks for joining me again, everyone, this week.
Surely. Thank you, Steve. Good
thanks,
times.
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.